Hey, what's up, everybody? My name's MJ, and you're listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. As usual, I'd like to give a quick shout-out to my local game store, Guardian Games. You can find Guardian Games on the web at ggportland.com. Today's episode of the podcast is another in the Control Room series, where I bring my longtime friend Ryan on to talk about all aspects of Magic the Gathering. So, without further ado, I'd like to reintroduce Ryan back to the show.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's El Rhino.
El Rhino.
El Rhino.
Is we going to call you from that from now on?
Yeah, that's my name. That's my street name.
Sure. Yeah. Anyway, so last time on the Control Room podcast, we talked about the Lorwyn Shadowmoor block, which Ryan credited as being his really... I suppose reintroduction to the game, I suppose, is a fair way to determine.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
When I first kind of became enfranchised is what I'd say.
Yeah. So on today's episode, we're kind of going off that same bit there. And I know we hinted at it at the end of the last episode that we were going to talk about my first set and how it got me into the game. And that set, if you've been listening to the podcast for a long time, you already know this, but if you haven't been listening or you've conveniently forgotten, the first set that I started playing in Magic the Gathering was War of the Spark. Now, again, if you're interested in the Vorthos aspect, it was a very awkward time to get into the game because there was just so much stuff going on that you have to parse out. But as far as just the set, I definitely have a special place in my MTG player heart for this set because not only was it my first set... So it's the set that I most closely associate with my learning about the game, but also just the fact that I've come to enjoy actually a lot of the cards in this set, and I do play a lot of these cards within my EDH decks.
Hmm.
So, again, this is... Yeah, War of the Spark came out a couple years ago, and was basically the culmination of a years-long storyline in the Magic the Gathering storyline. Again, I'm not going to really...
Probably more like a 12-year... Well, no, it... 2019, 2018? No, that would be probably about eight, nine years,
yeah. I mean, kind of
off or on,
But yeah, a very long story came to a head in this set. So there is a lot to really unpack there. If you want to go into the Vorthos aspect, again, I'm not going to go into that because that goes off in a whole other can of worms. It's really kind of outside the point of this episode. What I'm here to talk about today are the cards in the set. Now,
so
again,
I started, well, not first playing, but when I was really enfranchised, I started right before the Alara block, which was the very beginning of this MTG storyline, right? Mm-hmm. And you started here, which is the very end of this storyline. Well, so it kind of bookends.
Not really the end of it, just kind of the culmination of everything that would have started in your block as it came to a head within one set, really.
Yeah.
Anyway... So this set is well known for a lot of cards, actually, even though I've heard that the community actually is really divided on this set. I think that expectations were really high coming to the set, coming out of the third trip to Ravnica for Allegiance and Guild of Ravnica. And I think there is kind of an unfair stigma on this set that, you know, people felt that this was kind of a lame sealed environment, that they didn't really jive with a lot of the mechanics. And, I mean, honestly, I'm not much of a sealed player, but I enjoyed it. It was my first chance to learn the game. I didn't have to worry about a lot of extremely complicated mechanics. I mean, honestly, the most complicated mechanic out of this whole set was Amass, and that was fairly easy to figure out. So for a new player like myself, I honestly found the set extremely easy to jump into, because you really had Amass and Proliferate, and they were very self-explanatory mechanics. So I didn't really have to worry about things that were more complicated that came out in the previous sets, you know, something like Surveil, or it came out of one of the prior Ravnica sets there, which, you know, it requires a little bit more understanding of the game. And Proliferate and Amass, you know, they work with +1/+1 counters. They're very simple to understand. Proliferate allows you to add another counter, while Amass allows you to create a zombie friend, or, you know, make a zombie army much larger. So I think just on the outset, if we just look at the mechanics there, they were fairly simple, you know, for the majority of things. Obviously, we're not going to get in this one into the finales, because those obviously have a much different focus. But I think as far as like the main bits in this set were fairly easy to understand.
Oh yeah. Well, the finales are their own cycle to talk about, really.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about this set, just kind of how I got into the game on here. And it's kind of hard to say this, honestly, but, you know, just trying to get into the game itself, I used War of the Spark as a kind of a measuring stick for what I expected from sets going back in Magic's history. Obviously, I opened a lot of War of the Spark when I was just starting out, back when I believed the opening booster packs would get you all the singles that you would need, kind of foolishly, but, you know, that's the way you used to do it.
Well, it's 100% true. Just keep on opening booster packs to get everything you need.
Yep. If only I had known. But, again, so this was my first opportunity to see a lot of cards, and the fact that there was a lot of synergy, or at least that there was a lot of similarity on the cards to one another, I think definitely helped me in the fact that it kind of created a cohesive story, I suppose. Is that it helped me start to understand, you know, not only some of the mechanics, but also get the idea of, okay, here's the rarities, here's what you're going to expect from commons, uncommons, and rares, here's what the different colors are good at. You know, the blue's going to draw you cards or try to counter spells. You know, the red's going to try to be more aggressive, try to get some aggressive creatures out there, use burn spells. Green's going to be using a lot of proliferate. White's going to be doing what white usually does best, and that is trying to put +1/+1 counters on things, attack, untap, exile, and it just goes on and on from there. And you also just have a bevy of planeswalkers. Again, this was a set where you had a planeswalker of any rarity in every single pack, and so we ended up seeing a lot of returning characters from throughout Magic's history coming back in this set, especially in the uncommon rarity for the first time, where you started having planeswalkers with no plus ability, but also the first planeswalkers that had a static ability as well.
Yeah, no, those were some pretty new things to stick on to planeswalkers, at least the static abilities in particular. Have now become like a mainstay of planeswalkers since War of the Spark. So obviously that was a mechanical deviation that has been accepted and seems to be relatively popular.
Yeah, because we've definitely seen a lot more development in this style from Wizards of the Coast in the last 2 years. That now planeswalkers have all sorts of interesting abilities stapled to them where you don't necessarily need to use the ability. That was definitely something that War of the Spark pioneered, although there are the rare planeswalkers which do have plus abilities. So we're looking at, what, about 10 or so planeswalkers that came in uncommon? 10, exactly. Exactly.
A bunch.
10. And again, they're
a
in
crap all, ton
they're,
of,
there's
of,
one
of
in
planeswalkers.
Each, there's one in each of the 10 Ravnica Guild pairing colors. So you're no matter what colors you were in for a sealed event, you're likely going to be able to utilize at least one of them, if not two.
There's so many freaking planeswalkers. This is single-handedly got planeswalkers into the hands of more people, I think, than any other set.
Sure. It's really what got me into understanding how to use the game. I mean, I remember, and I'm going to use this anecdote again, that the Liliana Dreadhorde General Planeswalker was actually my first chase card. It was the first card that I thought, hey, if I could open this in the booster pack, this is going to be a really good card. And I remember opening up one of the set boosters, or sorry, not set boosters, one of those theme boosters that they had released just prior. And I was kind of wondering if I would ever get that, but I took a shot on a couple of mono black theme boosters, and the first booster, lo and behold, there you go. Your $20 Planeswalker card. And it was definitely one of the cards that helped me get into Magic, was basically, here's a generically powerful card that does powerful things. I had built a, you know, middling zombie deck for my local game store for Friday Night Magic, and this went in perfectly with that. So the fact is that, yes, I am not saying crack booster packs for value.
Definitely. Wholeheartedly recommend just crack it. All booster packs. Definitely not a shell for Wizards of the Coast.
This set did have that chase card for me, which kind of helped set me up for understanding not only how planeswalkers work,
dude, but also cracking just... Cracking a $20 card is pretty dang good. I mean,
it really is.
I've had some pretty good luck as well, too, though, I will admit.
Yeah, but again, this set also just had a lot of very good value cards. Again, if you have listened to our episode on some of our favorite cards in Magic or some of our uncommon cards that really pack a punch that we've done in the past, a couple of the cards from War of the Spark actually ended up on those lists. So I'm going to cite Liliana's Triumph, which was, again, the first promo card that I ever received, so it definitely has a special place in my heart for that, also because it's really good. That's an instant for one and a black, and reads, each opponent sacrifices a creature. If you control Liliana Planeswalker, which I typically don't, each opponent also discards a card. But the fact that you can force your opponents to sacrifice a creature and each opponent for 2 mana at instant speed is not to be underestimated. As well as my longtime favorite Lazatep Reaver, which is a common for one and a black. It's a 1/2 zombie beast, and it reads, whenever Lazatep Reaver enters the battlefield, amass one. So effectively, for 2 mana, you're able to get 2 power and 3 toughness across 2 bodies onto the battlefield, guaranteed. And this was really the crux of that zombie deck I just mentioned a few moments ago, because I would run 4 copies of Lazatep Reaver in there, because there's just no downside to playing that card. And I just like the fact that you can get a couple of bodies out there. If you end up losing one of them, you still have another body out there. And that was the kind of value that, you know, as a new player, you really want to try to stick with. A lot of the things in this set were still too challenging for me to understand. But the fact that I could effectively get 2 creatures for 2 mana in mono black was really a turning point for me, trying to understand not only the value of tokens, but just trying to understand the concept of enter the battlefield triggers and just value trains.
Yeah, I remember this was a couple of years back again. I think when you moved back over here, you had a couple of those kinds of decks that featured a lot of War of the Sparks cards pretty heavily, I recall. I think you had an Amass deck as well.
Something like that, yeah.
Zombie one. That was a while ago. Do you still have that thing?
I don't know if I still have that one. I've taken most of those decks from those days apart, because obviously those were the first decks I'd ever built. But I still have the mono black zombies deck, mostly sleeved. It's just not sitting with my EDH decks, because I obviously I picked up EDH and I kind of dropped out of the whole 60 card format thing very early. Oh, yeah. So, you know, again, with me just not really being able to get into the other formats, it's kind of languished. That deck has languished on its own, oddly enough. Yeah. Maybe someday I'll be able to pick it up again. It's decent. I'm not going to say it's modern playable, but I mean, it's fun to play. Huh. And kind of the kitchen table mono black zombies deck that's fun to play, utilizing a lot of core cards from War of the Spark, just happens to have them.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then other cards that, again, my very first EDH deck that I ever really started playing, which, again, if you've been listening, was effectively an amalgamation of 3 60-card kitchen table decks in a 100-card singleton deck. I utilized quite a few of these War of the Spark cards, actually. I was utilizing Awakening of Yudugazi, which puts 9/11 counters on target land you control, Bloom Hulk, which allows you to proliferate when it ETBs, Evolution Sage, which proliferates whenever land enters the battlefield, Courage in Crisis, Giant Growth even, Mowu Loyal Companion. Again, it was green, black, but I was running a lot of the green effects because, you know, that's just what I had in the card pool. Return to Nature, Storm the Citadel for a, you know, decent overrun effect. Yeah. And just and again, all the black cards I already mentioned, plus, you know, a few other things, Shriek Diver. I had a copy or two of Massacre Girl, which, you know, even at the time, I didn't understand how that worked. I just thought, okay, you know, you can give everything -1/-1 until on turn.
It's a better card than you'd think. You have to really think about it.
Yes, but I didn't understand the concept of the chain reaction at the time. So yeah, it looked a little weak. And also another... Excuse me. Another standby for me, Dread Malkin. 1/1 zombie cat for 1 with menace. And you can pay 2 and a black and sacrifice another creature or planeswalker to put 2+1/+1 counters on Dread Malkin. And this is something that I really wish was pauper playable, because it would go perfectly in my pauper deck if it was a common.
Yeah, I'm guess I'm not super familiar with the Malkin. I am familiar with the Massacre Girl though. That is a card I've done a lot of thinking about in terms of its potential for some kind of very, very frustrating, infuriating kind of deck using that as a commander.
So when we go into blue, a lot of people think about the set and think about Narset, Parter of Veils, which
Oh,
is
yeah.
the wheels. Effectively, you can't draw cards, or you can only draw one card per turn. Lock, as well as Narset's Reversal. And while those cards are powerful, and I do actually own a copy of both of them, what I look at in blue for War of the Spark is cards that really stood out to me were actually the instants that were not Narset's
Yeah.
Reversal. And I'm talking in particular about Teferi's Time Twist and Lazatep Plating. And these are two of my favorite cards to throw in every single blue deck that I own for EDH. Lazatep Plating is an instant for one and a blue and reads amass one. So again, you get a 1/1 body even if you're not playing black just by paying two mana. So same thing as Lazatep Reaver. The value is there. And it reads you and permanents you control gain hexproof until end of turn. This card has saved my permanent so many times I cannot count. It is a very valuable card, and it's super cheap. It's only 47 cents right now if you look at the TCG player cost. So
That's
while that
Lazatep plating.
has gone
Yeah.
up a little bit, I mean, the fact it's just an uncommon, and it is uncommonly good. I know I talked about it in one of our episodes previously, and I just can't stop raving about this card because it's so dang
Yeah.
good.
Well, Lazatep Reaver, I think it's an underappreciated redirection kind of ability. I think it can really pull the trap card on somebody for with that thing, and I think it. You know, being able to make your creature invulnerable temporarily is nothing to be scoffed at, particularly when it's efficiently costed.
Yeah, and again, I have used that card so many times. It's just so good. And Teferi's Time Twist is an instant also for one and a blue and reads exile target permanent you control, not just creature, permanent. And you return that card to the battlefield under its owner's control at the beginning of the next end step. If it enters the battlefield as a creature, it enters with an additional +1/+1 counter on it. And what's nice about this particular card, especially with Lazatep Plating also in the same deck, is the fact that not only can I save a particular creature should I need to, and it gets stronger when it returns, but target permanent. So if you have something extremely scary on the board, I'm trying to think of my mono blue deck, one of the card draw doublers, let's say Allhomorant's Archive or something, something that whenever I draw a card, I get to double those cards. Well, all of a sudden, if someone tries to blow those up, which does happen a lot in our meta, particularly, Teferi's
Yeah.
Time Twist will allow me to protect that card for just two mana. And honestly, it's so good because a lot of these kinds of flicker effects require you to flicker a creature, and the fact that you can flicker a target permanent you control just really sets that over the top, makes that card for me, honestly.
Yeah, it's a pretty good blink spell, particularly in blue, but particularly in attempting to have something, so say your commander or something high value, like survive a board wipe, or even like a targeted form of removal. I think it's pretty good for that purpose.
Now, for mono white, obviously a lot of these cards don't really fit into a lot of the decks that I run because they don't really have. We'll just say that a lot of them are kind of draft chaffy types. And while I do try to find a lot of homes for these cards, in a lot of cases, I'm not necessarily trying to do in the deck what these cards are trying to do, for
Yeah.
lack of a better term. But things that have helped me in the past include Gideon's Triumph, which is an instant for one and a white. Reads target opponent sacrifice a creature that attacked or blocked this turn. So kind of like Liliana's Triumph, just that if someone's going to attack you, you can blow up one of their attackers or blockers.
Woohoo.
I've utilized single combat once or twice, which is a sorcery for three white-white. Each player chooses a creature or planeswalker they control, then sacrifices the rest. Players can't
So
cast
that's kind
creatures.
of like a Winds of Wrath slash, crap, I can't remember the other
It's
ability that
Divine
usually takes out
Reckoning on
Divine Reckoning, yeah.
just that it prevents players from casting creature planeswalker spells until the end of your next turn.
There's even more wipes like that that affect usually like only everything other than like a singular creature, for example. and they're useful when you're, you can get that kind of asymmetric advantage to it. You can break the symmetry.
Mm-hmm. And I did talk about this card a couple weeks ago in one of the White is Good Actually series on the Mono White Jumpstart packs, but even Makeshift Battalion, which is a common human soldier for 2 and a white, it's 3/2, and reads, whenever Makeshift Battalion and at least 2 other creatures attack, put a +1/+1 counter on Makeshift Battalion. This is a card I have looked at for a long time. It's never really made it to my EDH decks, but I consider this card to be kind of one of those, hey, this is good value, just turn your creature sideways. It's a good payoff for creature combat, and I definitely attribute a lot of my interest in creature combat to cards like this, which give you those valuable payoffs for turning creatures sideways. It's as simple as that.
If you need to make a swarm of white weenie creatures, then that's definitely follows into the archetype.
Going on to red, we get another one of the cards that I know I highlighted on in my section of the uncommon cards of the Pack-a-Punch series, and that is Bolt Bend. Bolt Bend is an instant for 3 and a red, and reads, the spell costs 3 less to cast if you control a creature with power 4 or greater. Change the target of target spell or ability with a single target. Now, again, there was a day before the card deflecting SWAT ever existed, and Bolt Bend was good then. I always found uses for it now. It's really good now. It will always be good, and it costs only 27 cents. Deflecting SWAT costs $30 right now. Bolt Bend costs 27 cents. You should buy this for every single deck you own that runs red. It is good.
I think Bolt Bend and Dovin's Veto, I think, are two of the most powerful, like, instant answers to that were printed in War of the Spark. I think Bolt Bend is way underappreciated. I think, compared to Deflecting SWAT, I think it's actually very, very close in terms of its payoff, Deflecting SWAT, except it's a little different, a little bit more flexible, given that it's based on having a big creature rather than just a commander. But basically, the idea of paying one to basically fork a spell is really good. It's a pretty good payoff, considering that a Reverberate is a 2-drop. So you're dang near dropping one mana to move something else your way. And if you have anything with power 4 or greater, which you're going to have a lot of that in Commander, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And even if you don't, I mean, the fact that you can still use pay retail on this for 4 mana, it's not, I guess, as bad as it sounds. I mean, sure, 4 mana in a fast EDH meta might be difficult to pull off, and I'm not going to say it's as good as Deflecting SWAT, but if you're looking for a slower game, kind of a lower mid to lower power kind of battlecruiser game, or if you're building a budget deck list, Bolt Bend really should be in your deck. It's only 27 cents.
And you're going to want to play with a deck that's going to have something with the requisite power out at all times when you're playing something like this.
Sure. Other cards that I wanted to touch on in red include Burning Prophet, which is a 1/3 human wizard, another common, and reads, whenever you cast a non-creature spell, Burning Prophet gets +1/+0 until end of turn, then scry 1. Again, this is really nice for those red decks, red Spellslinger decks especially, where you're potentially going to be drawing cards, doing top deck manipulation, things like that. So you're going to be able to cast a lot of non-creature spells. Again, the buff doesn't really mean much unless you're going to be attacking with it, but the Scry 1 trigger could really help you out if you're trying to dig through your deck for an answer.
Yeah.
Obviously, there is Dreadhorde Arcanist, which is a 1/3 zombie wizard that is actually banned in Legacy. So
it's good. It's good.
I think that should demonstrate just how good this set was. If you just look at the mono-colored cards, just and what I've been talking about for these colors, is the fact that you have at least one card banned in Legacy, I think means that, you know, their Wizards was trying to push the envelope a little bit.
Red got some good cards, that's sure.
Another one I really like, and then I made sure that I sent you over the holiday season, actually, is Honor the God Pharaoh. And I love this card for red card draw. Again, it is a sorcery for 2 and a red, and reads, as an additional cost to cast a spell, discard a card, as you typically will for red card draw of this type. and you draw two cards and amass one. So now you're going to be saying to yourself, well, MJ, look, you can draw two cards with Thrill of Possibility, Instant Speed. Why would you run this? Redundancy. Also, the fact that I just really like the amass trigger. Anytime you can pay one mana to get a 1-1 on the battlefield to help yourself, especially in combat-heavy metas like we have to deal with, it's always worth it. Trust me. You never know when a 1-1 could potentially tip the balance or save your life as a jump blocker. So while this is overcost in some cases, you're still going to get two cards. You have some discard synergies, and you're going to get that plus one counter on a zombie army, guaranteed.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's something that I was running for a while in my mono red EDH deck. I think it changed out for something, but I was running it in adjacent to Thrill of Possibility, Tormenting Voice, etc. Fearless Looting. It's a really good cycler for red. It has a little bit of an upside tacked onto it. It is sorcery speed, and it's a little different than the other ones, which I think is why I sort of switched it out. But it's a really good one if you need more of that type of card in your deck, in addition to the other ones.
Yeah. It's just good redundant card draw for your third, fourth option, I feel, especially mono red. And the last card I wanted to touch on this color was Spellgorger Weird. 2/2 Weird, and reads, whenever you cast a non-creature spell, put a +1/+1 counter on Spellgorger Weird. I already did a whole episode on this card specifically, so if you want to really go back, really dig deep into the archives of the MTG in Quarantine podcast, you can listen for about 7 minutes as I talk about how much I really like Spellgorger Weird. So I won't go into it too much now.
Oh yeah.
Moving on to green. Obviously everyone thinks about Finale of Devastation. There is a reason for that. It is a really good card.
It's a big boy spell.
I'm not gonna sugarcoat this.
Big Timmy spell. Big Timmy spell.
But you also had a lot of other really good cards. You had Nissa, who shakes the world, who allows you to basically double your forests. You have let's see, what else here? You have God Eternal Romance.
With that Finale of Devastation, though, you could basically just have the card be named Incoming, and it would be, and it would like still be a legitimate title for it, because it's basically what it is. It's just like, oh crap, look out.
Yep. You also have one of my first rares, which was God Eternal Ronus. And Ronus is a 5/5 zombie god, costs 3 green-green, and has Death Touch. When God Eternal Ronus enters the battlefield, double the power of each other creature you control until end of turn. Those creatures gain vigilance until end of turn. And then the same God Eternal clause, where when it dies or is put in exile from the battlefield, it may put it into its owner's library third from the top. So this is a really good finisher in the overrun style abilities. The fact that you can drop for 5 mana, all your creatures gain vigilance and double their power. So they don't gain trample. So again, it may not be as flexible as your overrun effects, but the fact that when it dies, it returns to your deck, if you can draw it out again, or, you know, a couple turns later on, draw it back. I think the fact that this kind of ability is on a permanent, and also just an ETB, so you can flicker this or whatnot, you could, Teferi's Time Twist this, and then get it back on your next turn. And then the fact is, a 5/5 Death Touch body for 5 mana is never going to be bad. Let's just be honest.
Yeah, it's an interesting spin on the god cards that we got from Amonkhet, from the Amonkhet block.
Yep. So moving on to the multicolored cards, things that see a lot of play, at least in my decks anyway, include, or at least I used to play this a lot. I don't play a lot of Golgari anymore, which is kind of weird to say, some point I'll get back to my roots of playing Golgari. But anyway, Death Sprout was one of those interesting things that I played a lot back when I was first getting into the game. So it's an instant for 1 black green and reads, destroy target creature. Search your library for a basic land card, put it on the battlefield tapped, then shuffle your library. Destroy target creature at instant speed and ramp. You know, it just sets you up for future turns. Sure, it's overly costed for destroying a creature.
Yeah, it's
but
a little expensive.
Let's be honest, it's still a really cool card, and it's got some really nice art on it.
I mean, yes, it's not a putrefy. It's not a all the other Golgari discombobulate basic spells. Yes, there are a bunch of them that are really good. Golgari does really well at basically just destroying random permanents. but Desperado does give you the land in addition, so that makes it kind of a situational piece of ramp and a situational removal all in one, which I think is kind of great when you're running both green and black. You can always utilize that.
Mm-hmm. It may not be playable in every deck, but saying that it's not commander playable at all is a huge misconception. Another card that actually I think no one says is not playable in EDH is D-Spark. D-Spark is the Orzhov colors, so it just costs an Orzhov, so white, black, for an instant that reads exile target permanent, again, target permanent, with converted mana cost 4 or greater. And honestly, let's face it, the EDH format is filled with permanents that have a mana value now 4 or greater. This card will just exile it. No frills, no hoops you have to jump through other than that for one white and one black mana at instant speed. It's that good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. It's joins the pantheon of cards like Utter End, Vindicate, Mortify. Well, Mortify, at this point, Mortify in terms of power creep has almost been crept out of the format except in, well, I like Mortify personally, but a lot of people, I guess, have kind of gone to, well, I mean, cards like D-Spark, for example, Anguished Unmaking, which is super powerful, if not the most powerful.
But costs almost $10, so I mean...
That's the one problem with that, is that, you know, again, there's an inflated cost of that. Mortify has been printed 9 billion times and has been around for ages and ages and ages, you know, and Utter End is not too expensive either, but, you know...
It costs
these
four.
Other removal options are getting pretty expensive, you know.
Yeah, and Utter End costs 4, whereas D-Spark costs only 2.
Well, D-Spark will be more expensive unless they consistently reprint it, because I think it's really good.
D-Spark was actually reprinted as a Mystical Archive card in Strixhaven, so the cost of that is actually less than 50 cents, and you can get the very nice Mark Tedden art.
That's cool.
Yeah, so if you're playing Orzhov colors or something like Mardu or whatnot, or even 5 color, this card is so good. Pick it up today. You will not regret it.
Yeah.
Moving on to, again, you mentioned this earlier, Ryan, Dovin's Veto. And this is an instant countering spell and cannot be countered for a single white and a blue for Azorius. And again, this is a card that, it's just really good. The fact it can't be countered makes it far more, I guess, playable in higher powered metas, and it's just really good. Now, it can only counter target non-creature spells, so if someone drops a Gary or, I don't know, one of the Eldrazi, it's not going to do anything to it. But in a meta where you're going to have a lot of non-creature spells, especially when you get to higher powered, you're going to be seeing a lot of things that you want to counter. This is unquestioned counter.
Usually you're going to, when you want to answer something and you're playing with high powered spells and you're slinging those things around, it's going to be a non-creature spell when there's something that's potentially game winning and that you think has a good chance of being counterspelled, then you play this, because this will guarantee that thing gets taken out. Unless someone has, I believe that if someone removes a spell from the game on the stack, I think it gets around that can't be countered.
Yeah, something like that.
There is a card or two that can do that in response to Dovin's Veto, but outside of those, there is no way to answer a Dovin's Veto. So that's what makes it so good.
Mm-hmm. Other cards that I really wanted to talk about today were, of course, Teferi, Time Raveler.
Oh, yeah.
And Teferi, Time Raveler... If you remember what I said about Dreadhorror Arcanist being banned, is super banned in multiple formats.
Super banned.
It was banned in Standard. It's still banned in both Historic and Pioneer right now.
Yeah, because Teferi aggravates people.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way.
And I do actually have a copy of it. I know I've used it against you more than once, and frankly, I don't find it all that much fun, but again, that's just me.
It's good.
Yeah, so Teferi Time Raveler, for those of you who have not heard the news on this one, is a 4 loyalty planeswalker, costs 1 white and a blue, has a static ability if each opponent can cast spells only any time they could cast a sorcery. So you can already start seeing where this goes. Mm-hmm. Plus one abilities until your next turn, you may cast sorcery spells as though they had flash. Which, so basically, not only are you hurting your opponents by making them work at sorcery speed, but now all of your sorceries can be played at flash speed.
Basically, it's a Vidalcan Orrery, that means that other opponents also are slowed down.
Yep, and the negative three ability is return up to one target artifact, creature, or enchantment to its owner's hand, and draw a card. So yeah, this is just good on its own for the static ability, but just the fact that you can give yourself flash speed for even one turn, well, actually, until your next turn, so you potentially have this for three turns. That's really good.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, anything that is capable of giving your own stuff flash is just really good in general, because it enables some really degenerate plays really quickly, and being able to effectively play things in response to other things at any time is very powerful in EDH, because of the whole way that it goes around the board, it being a multiplayer format, being able to respond at any stage in the turn order is very valuable.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of flash, I could not talk about flash and War of the Spark without talking about another card that I actually run in quite a few of my decks, and it's a land, actually, called Emergence Zone.
Uh-oh.
And Emergence Zone is a land that taps for one colorless mana, but you can also tap it, pay one, and sacrifice it so that you can cast spells this turn as though they had flash. So again, Vidalcan Orrery is extremely expensive, plus it also costs four mana to be able to get out there, and then everyone's going to be gunning for it in most cases, especially in our meta, they would. So Emergence Zone basically allows you to have a Vidalcan Orrery in your pocket, and to use it any time you need to be able to play at instant speed. And the fact that it's a land means you can tap it for mana early on. You know, it basically just acts as a waste. But then the fact that you can tap it, sacrifice it, and then play some other things out of your hand when you need to. So on someone's end step, let's say, well, all of a sudden, you've potentially just gotten around the summoning sickness problem if you're trying to cast a creature, or if you really need to do something important at flash speed. Well, all of a sudden, now you can do it at any time, just because you have that Emergence Zone available to you as a land.
Yeah, I think it's kind of an oddball little land from that set. I can't say I've really played it before, but it's very fascinating ability to have on a land. I think there's another one of that type. I can't remember if that was in... what set that was printed in? Was that printed in... The Fairy Tale set? Can't remember which one.
In Eldraine?
Eldraine? Was there one that gave stuff flash if you tapped it for something? Alchemist's Refuge or something
Yes, Alchemist's Refuge.
Is that from Eldraine?
No, it actually goes back further than that. But it requires you to be playing at least in Simic colors.
Yeah, Alchemist's Refuge is what I thought of when I first saw this card. It kind of reminds me a little bit in the same vein. Lets you do those clutch plays, you know.
Yeah, but again, the issue with Alchemist's Refuge, and I do play that in at least one of my decks, is the fact that you have to have at least four mana, or three or four mana available to be able to activate it, which, again, Emergence Zone only costs one. And also you have to be playing both blue and green in EDH to be able to get any sort of value out of it. So
it's color limited.
It's narrow. It's narrow. Whereas Emergence Zone can go in any deck. I run this in my Titania deck where I want to be destroying my own lands to get creatures. I utilize this in my deck that wants to be running more at flash speed. I even run this in my colorless Karn Silver Golem deck just because it is that good. It taps for colorless, and it allows me to do things at instant speed one turn, which could be a make-or-break turn for me, depending on what I have in my hand, how much mana I have open, and it's just nice to have as a utility in that deck, where I'm already basically running almost all non-basics anyway.
I mean, it could let you carry out a sequence of plays that could help, like, majorly disrupt the game, and be enabled by something like that, essentially for free.
Sure. And again, we're going to go back to the Planeswalkers here. There were some good ones, some that are maybe not as good. But again, what I like about the uncommon Planeswalkers, and again, these are the ones that don't have a plus loyalty ability. What I liked about them was that they really stuck to their guns regarding the static abilities. So some of them give your creatures various buffs. Samut Tyrant Smasher gives your creatures haste. Angrath gives all your creatures menace. Dovin allows all your artifacts, instant sorcery spells to cost one more to cast, so you're kind of taxing people. Saheeli allows you to create servos whenever you cast a non-creature spell. Kiora allows you to draw cards whenever creatures with power 4 or greater enter the battlefield. Nahiri gives all your creatures first strike as long as your turn. You kind of get the idea that each guild has a planeswalker representative, and a lot of them have very useful abilities. Again, maybe not the most useful, depending on if you're looking on your power level, quote-unquote, in EDH. But if you're playing kind of at the Battlecruiser mid-power level, I think some of these are actually quite useful. I do play a couple of them in my own personal decks.
There are some that are really suited for certain strategies. And then there's also the... goodness, I can't remember. Is it the... There's one of them that's really powerful.
Ashiok Dream Render is probably what you're thinking about.
That one, yeah, that one's a no fun one. There's another one which shuts down. Does it shut down tutoring, or does it shut down? It shuts down something.
Well, I did mention Narset earlier, which shuts down opponent's card draw. But yeah, Ashiok Dream Render is a legendary planeswalker, 5 loyalty for 1 Dimir Dimir, and reads spells and abilities your opponents control can't cause their controller to search their library. So you have a really nice fetch land there that you got from the brand new Modern Horizons 2 set. Can't use it. It's basically Aven Mind Sensor just improved. And has a negative one ability. Target player puts the top 4 cards of their graveyard of the library into their graveyard, then exile each opponent's graveyard. And Ashiok currently is only $1.68 if you want to do that sort of thing.
Ashiok is a mean one.
there's a reason why I don't play the card in my own personal decks. It's not really my playstyle, I'll say that much.
Yeah.
Another card before we kind of leave the multicolored cards here that I really like and I've found some use for in my deck is actually Tyrant's Scorn. This is an instant costing Dimir, so blue and a black, and reads, choose one. Destroy target creature with converted mana cost 3 or less, or return target creature to its owner's hand. Again, we've talked about modal spells before, but just the fact that for 2 mana you can either destroy a creature, a small creature, or you can return a target creature to its owner's hand, you're never going to really not have a time where this is not useful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Modal cards like that, I think, are particularly valuable. I know that there was a couple different modal cards that were, I think, introduced in War of the Spark, I believe.
There were a few, definitely.
Names escape me, I think, right now. Can't remember what those ones are. It's been some time since I reviewed the overall card list.
Casualties of War, Angrath's Rampage.
Oh, Casualties of War is excellent.
Yes, it is. Casualties of War is a sorcery for 2 black, black, green, green, and reads, choose one or more. Destroy target artifact. Destroy target creature. Destroy target enchantment. Destroy target land. Or destroy target planeswalker. And this is something you use in your Volrath deck.
Yeah, you know, you got that Gruul Anarchy card or whatever that is that lets you destroy one of a bunch of different types, I think. This is that, but it's like steroid.
Can't remember.
On steroids.
Yeah.
This one is nuts. It's not really a board wipe, per se. What it really is it's like, not the finale. From Alara, there's the one in Nicol Bolas colors, I think that lets you destroy a bunch of different types of things on the board.
Cruel Ultimatum.
Yeah, Cruel Ultimatum is, it kind of reminds me a little bit more in that vein than a board wipe, in that it's kind of like a targeted, like, destroy a bunch of things. Stuff. Yeah. And then of course there's also the one from there's a couple cards like that, and Casualties of War is particularly effective for something like Golgari if you want to destroy a bunch of things. Particularly useful in a multiplayer game because you're going to have more chance of hitting every single target that's listed there on that and accruing a lot more value. So it's kind of expensive, but I think it's really good because, especially in EDH, you're going to have a ton of high-value targets as the game gets going, and this can deal with any of them of almost any type.
And unlike the Gruul card, which again, the name is escaping me right now. I know I'm going to remember that. I know it's not Crash Through, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That card can actually fizzle out if you don't have enough valid targets. Casualties of War gets around that in the fact that you choose one or more. It could be an extremely expensive way to get rid of a Planeswalker if you need to, or you can blow up a whole bunch of things, but you're as long as you have valid targets, well, actually it doesn't even matter if you don't have a valid target, you just don't choose that mode. But the fact is you can choose as many as you can, or as you want. You don't have to worry about needing every single target to be valid, or else the entire spell fizzles.
Yeah, it's a modal card that doesn't make you choose one or the other. You can pick any amount that you want and get that value out of it.
All right. And again, before we start getting into the big like EDH bits of here, so basically the commanders, I did want to mention Nicol Bolas, Dragon God, before I left the section for obvious reasons, because not only was the set all about him, but the fact is this card is actually really good. And Nicol Bolas Dragon God is a Planeswalker with 4 loyalty that costs blue, black, 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 red, and reads, Nicol Bolas Dragon God has all loyalty abilities of all other Planeswalkers on the battlefield. So it's already really good in that vein, because there's a lot of good Planeswalkers in our format. So the fact that Nicol Bolas can basically copy each one of those plus have his own abilities is insane. And has 3 abilities, plus 1, you draw a card. Each opponent exiles a card from their hand or a permanent they control. The negative 3 ability is destroy target creature or planeswalker. And here's the big one. Negative 8. Each opponent who doesn't control a legendary creature or planeswalker loses the game. Well, I mean, if you're looking at player removal as a way to be able to beat people, this does that. There's a reason why it's over $10. Yeah. But the fact is that this was always Nicky B's set, and the card does not disappoint.
Yep, you got a big powerhouse one to round out the sets that he's included in.
Yep. All right, so we're going to move on really quickly to the commanders from this set. And obviously, it'd be remiss to talk about this set without talking about everyone's favorite Boros Angel, Feather the Redeemed. This is a card that on the day of recording, I actually just played a game against earlier, and I can vouch it's really good. No matter how you build it. And Feather Redeemed, for those who are not aware of what it is a 3/4 angel costing red, white, white, has flying, obviously. And whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell that targets a creature you control, exile that card instead of putting it into your graveyard as it resolves. If you do, return it to your hand at the beginning of the next end step. So effectively, this is a way to do Boros cantrips. There's a lot of white cards that cost one and allow you to draw a card and do various things. So Feather basically allows you, as long as you're targeting your own creatures, basically just value, 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 draw, draw, draw. It's a way in Boros to draw a whole lot of cards really quickly, but I feel like it's also pretty fragile in the fact that deck typically doesn't run a lot of other win cons despite Feather. So it's kind of a glass can in the way I look at it. But what do you think about this one, Ryan?
Well, it's it leads to a commander-centric playstyle, which in and of itself is a form of a style of play in Commander that has certain strengths, has certain weaknesses, and one of the aforementioned ones, one that you just mentioned, is that it tends to be vulnerable to strategies that can negate your commander or otherwise deal with your commander, because then you've lost one of the main impetuses that powers your deck. And I think a Feather Redeemed deck, that would be one example. Versus if you remember my Volrath deck, one time I did really, really well in a game, and I never actually played Volrath the entire game.
Yeah.
that I was doing. I actually was doing really, really well without even playing him. That would be like a commander agnostic, non-centric kind of deck style, where it's less vulnerable to kind of a removal or a method of negating a commander.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Feather is one of those things where I know a lot of people like it. It's a good card. I'm just saying it really depends on how you build it and exactly what you're trying to do with that deck. Zadahedron Grinder also has the same problem with it, is the fact that you're going to be running a lot of small creatures and you're trying to copy all the abilities. Well, if Zada's not on the battlefield, what are you going to do?
So, basically, if someone Darksteel Mutations Zada or any number of the... or oubliette or any of the other really nasty forms of like semi-permanent removal on your commander, then you're in big trouble unless you can find an answer to that problem really quickly.
Mm-hmm. But I will say that it entered new design space for Boros, and if you want to do a combat style Boros deck like I do, it's definitely worth a look if you want to try to use a lot of little cantrips in those colors.
Yeah.
And it really can work. I mean, this a lot of people like this deck. A lot of people play this deck. It is one of the most common... I mean, it is the most popular Boros deck on EDH Rec for a reason, and not, by a long margin, too.
Yeah.
Let's see. Other really good... Or, you know, other commanders. Again, this set didn't have a lot of really good commander options, a lot of good legendary creatures. Yeah. That was something that it was a little lacking in. Maybe that's the reason why a lot of people said that it wasn't a very good set. I don't know. But, again, the one that I do have in my collection is Storeb Dvkarin Lich. It's a zombie elf. Oh, she's a zombie elf wizard. 5-4 power toughness. Cost 1, black, black, green. Has trample. And whenever Storeb Dvkarin Lich deals combat damage to a player or planeswalker, return to your hand target creature or planeswalker card in your graveyard that wasn't put there this combat. So basically a way that when you deal combat damage, you're able to get things back from the graveyard and put in, let's see, return it to your hand.
Oh, yeah. It's been some time since I've last seen that card, actually.
Actually, funny thing about Storev is I actually did utilize this card to win one of the only games of Sealed that I've ever won. Just because I was able to get a 5-4. I actually had a couple of them in my Sealed pool once. And the fact that I was able to get one out there with 5-4 with Trample actually ended up being enough to win me the game. Not the match, but the game.
Oh. Well, that's good. Yeah.
I mean, and the other...
Whatever wins a game.
The other multicolored legendary in the set was Rolesque Apex Hybrid. And again, Rolesque got a lot better after the Commander Death Rule got changed about a year or so ago.
But before the Commander Death Rule, it was not a good choice, just to be, just to say, for Commander. But so Rolesque, after the Death Rule, it becomes substantially better.
Sure. So Rolesque is a 4-5 human mutant, costs 2 green, green, blue, has flying and trample. When Rolesque Apex Hydrate enters the battlefield, put 2+1/+1 counters on another target creature you control, something that can easily be abused. And then when Rolesque dies, proliferate, then proliferate again. So again, it has to die for this to be able to work, but the fact you're able to proliferate twice, plus then if you're able to flicker it, you're able to put a lot of counters on things, and just the fact that it's flying and trample means that it's a pretty solid card just on its own. It takes a little bit of work to set up. I'm not going to say it's an easy build necessarily, so if you're looking for an easy build in EDH, Out of the Set, Feather is far and wide above every other legendary creature. But, you know, if you're looking for something interesting in Simic, definitely look into Rolesque.
Yeah. I think it does really well in Simic because of that proliferate. I mean, it's a card that very much just plays directly into Simic's strengths, particularly when it comes to counter generation.
All right, then when we go to legendary creatures, we go to the monocolor creatures, and these are the rest of the God Eternal. So you have Kefnet, Bantu, did Hazoret have a card in this set? Probably not. Yeah, definitely not. Again, that's more of a Vorthos thing, and Oketra as well. And out of this, I've seen a lot of people run Oketra, because God Eternal Oketra is a 3-6 zombie god, costs 3 white-white, has double strike. Whenever you cast a creature spell, create a 4-4 black zombie war creature token with vigilance, and the same God Eternal clause as the rest of them. This is just a really good value card on mono white. You're going to be playing a lot of low-cost creatures, you're going to get a lot of 4-4 zombie creatures. Oketra smash, effectively.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, God Eternal Kefnet is harder to use, we'll just say that much. Kefnet is a 4-5 zombie god, costs 2 blue-blue, has flying, and you may reveal the first card you draw each turn as you draw it. Whenever you reveal an instant or sorcery card this way, copy that card and you may cast the copy. That copy costs 2 less to cast. So again, it's a more difficult card to use, I think, because you really have to build your deck in such a way that you're going to be able to have a lot of cards you want to copy. But on the other hand, Copying cards is always powerful, especially since Strixhaven came out with Magecraft and whatnot, which allows you to already copy spells. So this just kind of gives you some redundancy in a deck running a lot of those bits. And just the fact that, you know, if you run kind of mono, even mono blue Spellslinger here, there's a lot of good cards that you want to copy. If you want to Brainstorm, you can draw six cards. Even a Divination, you can draw four cards for what would that be, four mana?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so I mean, frankly, I really think that a God Eternal Kefnet deck could be built for like a $15 budget or less, and you could still have a really solid deck.
Yeah, if you're willing to build around him.
Sure.
Because it is really a build around kind of card. It's pretty specific.
Sure. But I again, just the way I look at it is I think this is the kind of card where you can really build on a super budget, because as long as you can copy cards and you can have a little bit of top deck work. So you're going to need things like Scry, Surveil, whatnot.
Yeah.
But with a little bit of work, I think this could definitely be worth it as a commander if you're interested in looking something mono blue that's a little bit off the beaten path, but is also extremely powerful.
Yeah.
God Eternal Bontu. 5/6 zombie god costing 3 black with menace. And when God Eternal Bontu enters the battlefield, sacrifice any number of other permanents, then draw that many cards. So again, you need a big board for this to work. But the fact that War of the Spark gives you a lot of amass, which gives you a lot of zombie tokens, things like Dreadhorn Invasion, Lazatev Reaver, allows you to have a lot of permanents to sacrifice to then draw a lot of cards. Honestly, I think that Bontu kind of is the... kind of along with Ronus, is you don't really have to build around him, I think, if you're going to build commander deck in that color. It kind of gives you value, but unlike Kefnet or Oketra, you can survive, I think, in a lot of cases without Bontu on the field.
Yeah, I think Bontu is kind of just like a value engine, and a little bit more generic-y in that way, I think.
Sure. And there's a reason why he's significantly less than some of the others in terms of actual monetary cost.
Yeah.
It's just because he just doesn't have the same, I guess, game-bending power that some of the other ones do. I mean, even Ronus allows you to double the power of all your permanents and give them vigilance, which is really good in a mono-green stompy deck. Bontu, there are other cards that do the same thing. Again, they're a lot older. But, yeah, Bontu, the fact that you can do this constantly, I mean, again, it can work very well in an Aristocrats deck. This is a very good mono-black Aristocrats commander, just it's a little clunkier, I think, than the other ones, because you don't have as, and again, I'm going to say this kind of carefully, is you have a lot of value stapled to Bontu, you have to jump through more hoops to be able to access that value.
Yeah, I do think, yeah, I think I'd say it's a little less powerful than some of the other ones. At least I've seen a lot of people run God Eternal Oketra. I think that's definitely one of the ones that people utilize a lot. And then also, you know, Ronus. Not as much the Bontu.
Mm-hmm. All right, and we did already talk about Massacre Girl, so I'm not going to go back into that one.
Massacre Girl is a pretty strange card, but it if you want to make a board wipe your commander, like your commander be a board wipe, and not do the Nevinaral Lich Lord, I mean, like, he's technically a board wipe commander too, but you want something that's a little bit more straight up, plays into, you know, Black's kind of like Plague Wind strengths, then Massacre Girl is for you.
And the fact that you can get around Indestructible is what really makes Massacre Girl work. If you can get that chain reaction going, the fact that you potentially have opponents who have indestructible creatures, well, they don't anymore. Because you're going to blow up everything except for Massacre Girl.
Yeah, pretty much nothing will protect their creatures. As long as there's enough really weak things lying around to be able to help it chain off, it kills everything.
Mm-hmm. And again, that was something that I didn't quite understand when I was first getting into the game, but now I definitely see the value of Massacre Girl, having, you know, been victim to it a couple of times.
Yeah.
And there was also Neheb, Dreadhorde Champion. Neheb is a 5/4 zombie Minotaur warrior. Somehow they got all that in the template. I don't know how, but they did.
I don't know. They squeezed it in there somehow.
Neheb is a...
Made the font like size 4.
Yeah. Has trample, costs 2 red, and reads, whenever Neheb Dreadhorde Champion deals combat damage to a player, Planeswalker, you may discard any number of cards, going back to the red card draw. If you do, draw that many cards and add that much red mana. Until end of turn, you don't lose this mana as steps and phases end. So again, it's a lot of hoops to jump through. You have to have a lot of cards in your hand to be able to discard. You have to be able to get Neheb through. But the fact that you can generate red mana and draw some cards, there are synergies there that can work. And this is, I think this is one of the underrated commanders from the set, is that it allows you card draw, it allows you to do some damage. It's a 5/4 trampler for 4. That's never a bad thing.
Yeah.
And gives you some sweet mana to then be able to utilize with some newer cards.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I think he's a little different than his previous iteration. I think his previous iteration's a little more popular, but I think both of them do really well heading up a red deck where you want to go through cards and you want to smack people for some damage pretty rapidly. Kind of in a different from, I mean, yeah, it would also enable like a Punisher strategy, but mostly like a red spell slinger kind of strategy based around casting a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Moving on back to mono green, we have Mowu, Loyal Companion.
The Dogu.
and this is something, this is actually a commander that EDH rec in their podcast a long time ago, or actually, I guess not that long ago, but about a year ago or so, did highlight as being one of the cheapest decks to build on average across all the legendary creatures in Magic the Gathering. Mowu is a 3/3 hound, costs 3 and a what? 3 and a green, wow. And has trample and vigilance. If one or more +1/+1 counters will be put on Mowu Loyal Companion, that many +1 are put on instead. So effectively hardening scales on a creature.
Yeah, so basically dump a bunch of stuff onto him, make him even bigger, swing for the win, kind of, is where it is. And then have other things that enable that, you know. Yeah.
This is the kind of deck where giant growth is going to be extremely playable. Just because you want a lot of low-cost spells, you're going to want a lot of those low-cost +1/+1 things, including some cards from War of the Spark, including Pollenbright Druid, which you can either put a +1/+1 counter on a target creature or proliferate when it enters the battlefield. I did use Iron Shell Beetle from back when I used to have a +1/+1 counters style deck. I did run a couple copies of Mowu. Again, 60 card kitchen table deck. But I did run a couple copies of that. And Iron Shell Beetle was nice because I had 4 copies of it. And just put a +1/+1 counter on a target creature when ETB'd. So you put that on Mowu, all of a sudden it's a 5/5 now. And you kind of get incremental value over time. And you're probably just going to use Mowu as a win condition in a Voltron-style deck with a lot of cards that are extremely cheap. Not only to cast, but also just monetary. I mean, Giant Growth, honestly, is 6 cents on TCG Play right now.
Yeah.
You're going to be playing that in a Mowu deck, probably.
Yeah. Mostly cards like that.
Yeah.
Or equipments or something like that. Things that, like, enable your commander, I guess, kind of like a stompy Voltron sort of deck.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now that we've really talked about a lot of the cards that I've enjoyed about the set, Ryan, I want to hear some of your thoughts about this set and just kind of go into what you liked about the set and what you think some of the takeaways are now that we're a couple of years out from the set's release.
When this set came out, I was kind of in a zoned out Magic phase where I had kind of popped in during the game during Amonkhet and then popped back out again, so kind of missed War of the Spark in terms of like actually playing with War of the Spark cards. Not until I got back into the game again have I kind of really had a chance to go back through some of the cards that really came out between Amonkhet and I guess I'd say that the Theros Beyond Death block kind of is where I kind of popped back in.
Yeah, that was the last pre-release that we actually did.
Yeah, and that was the last pre-release we did in the before times. before the plague hit. I'd say War of the Spark has a lot of goodies in terms of things that I like seeing from it. I really like, there are a lot of powerful red cards in here. You've also got some pretty good stuff. Boltbend is one of my favorites here. You've got some pretty good burn spells. Was Thousand Year Storm from this one? Where the spark, or was that from?
I think that was from one of the Ravnica sets.
Oh, okay. So then maybe that was from the set that preceded it, possibly.
Yeah, I think it was. Though Ralstorm's Conduit is from this
set. Oh, yeah, yeah. Some really crazy Spellslinger kind of cards. You had some Teferi cards, which were really good in terms of bouncing stuff back from people. It was Electro Dominance from War of the Spark?
Am I confusing
that from a previous set?
I think it's still from one of the Ravnica Allegiance or Guilds.
I seem to lump all those things together in my mind a little bit, you know, when I think about them. They kind of fuse together. That could be because I wasn't early around. I had kind of dipped out for a little while before bopping back in, so that could be why. But I like the proliferate theme in War of the Sparks, especially the fact that they added proliferate mechanics to basically all the colors of Magic, lets you do some pretty unusual stuff and opened up a lot of strategies around +1/+1 counters and colors other than just like Selesnya and like mono green, where that you can utilize counter themes a little bit more effectively in stuff like Golgari or in Sultai kind of colors. In fact, I use a bunch of cards from War of the Spark in my Volrath deck, counter-themed deck, because there's a number of proliferate cards that were added. You mentioned the Pollenbright Druid. That's one card I run. I think there's one or two other proliferate cards that I also run in that are from War of the Spark. I think that those represent a really good value, especially when they're, even if they're just, you know, tacked on value onto a card, I think that they have the potential to really get out of control, particularly, you know, if you're playing something like Infect, or you're already playing other proliferate cards, or trying to maximize the number of counters that you can put on things. I like that, like, mini theme to it. In terms of, like, the Planeswalkers, I don't really run a lot of Planeswalkers in any decks that I run. In fact, I'm trying to It's been a long time since I've really even put a Planeswalker in a deck.
You used the Jaya from this set.
Oh yeah. Which one was that?
The one that adds an extra damage every time you do damage to an opponent.
Oh, yeah, Jaya Ballard. Yeah. Okay, yes, yeah. That one I also used for a while. That one's actually pretty good. I think Teo the Shield Mage was kind of a cool card too. If I ever decide to get around to making like a wall tribal deck or something like that, then
Teo the Shield Mage,
Planeswalker,
for those who don't know, is a 5 loyalty Planeswalker, costs 2 and a white, and reads, "You have Hexproof," which is a very valuable ability. And a -2 ability, create a 0/3 white wall creature token with Defender.
So it's got that like warding orbs kind of ability there, and it gives you Hexproof, and it can make walls. So if you're playing like an Arcades deck or like similar kind of walls deck, then you can use Teo to also make walls. And then like if you find a way to also add counters back on a Teo, you could make even more walls. So that's pretty funny. The first time I'm aware of a Planeswalker making walls, opens up some new possibilities in terms of creature types and how they interact with Planeswalkers. I really liked a lot of looking back on it, I can't really say past tense because I wasn't really playing a ton when War of Spark came out, but cards that I've picked up now, I think that there's quite a number of cards that that I think are pretty impactful. I mean, we mentioned Dovin's Veto earlier. That's pretty much a staple now. I think it's one of the better counter spells ever printed, particularly if you're looking at higher power kind of environments or environments where you're running the risk that someone's going to like force at will one of your counter spells or something, or one of your doohickeys, then yeah, you can always run Dovin's Veto and something like that. I really like some of the flavor around some of the cards. I like that it kind of plays into the themes going on at the time. It like pictures different events, like, you know, how D-Spark pictures Nicol Bolas's D-Sparking by I think it was Bantu and
Oketra, I believe.
Oketra with the big old spear, with Liliana going, oh, derp, 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 and then making them poke, give the unholy poke to the old Bolas. Yeah. You know, that's pretty cool. I like how the cards tie into the theme, the cards tie into the storyline, the cards are I think well designed. Actually, I think this set in terms of power level, I think is at a level that I think is definitely sufficient. I don't know about people saying it's a weak set. I mean, when I look back on sets, it's certainly more powerful than a lot of ones that have actually, I think, been printed in the last 20 years. Immediately, stuff like Kamigawa comes to mind. I mean, I guess that's kind of a cheap shot, though.
Sure, sure,
Kamigawa
sure.
is really bad. But
I think some of the... some of the issues people had with it maybe is the fact that it maybe wasn't the best sealed or limited environment, because a lot of these cards don't necessarily lend themselves to a good sealed environment. I mean, you're let's face it, you're probably not going to get much value out of a Narset or half of these planeswalkers in a limited environment. Obviously, things like Angrath are going to be great in sealed. But your rare planeswalkers may not. I mean, even Liliana is probably not as great in sealed, unless you're able to really get a good value engine going, sacrificing creatures, etc. So, I mean, not saying it's bad, but I can see why, you know, there's a lot of chaff in this set too.
I think a lot of people were a little bit peeved about the set, because from what I've heard, it led to planeswalkers kind of briefly like flooding into standard and flooding into EDH and flooding all over the place and just showing up everywhere in an annoying fashion. And of course, it also enabled Super Friends decks super hard, like in ways that had never been seen prior to that, because you suddenly had a ton of cards that could interact well with other planeswalkers and other planeswalker effect kind of cards. So
plus you also have Teferi, Time Raveler here, which is just salt inducing on so many levels. As well as Ashiok and Narset. I mean, even right now, again, the commander community is really dealing with I think it's really overblown in a lot of ways, but just talking about how Wheels decks have become very powerful and are very difficult to stop because of new cards that have been printed. But again, Narset is running a lot of those decks to be able to shut people off from drawing cards on wheel effects, and that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. It's a very powerful card. I'm not going to sit here and tell people that it's not a powerful card. It is extremely powerful, and it's definitely the reason why Wheels decks have gotten extremely efficient now that Hull Breacher is a thing.
Yeah, I mean, kind of one of the weird legacies, I think, of War of the Spark is that it introduced some Staxy cards back into the meta, which wasn't, you don't see very many Staxy kind of cards printed in any given set. The fact that there were three cards that were known to nullify or otherwise obstruct an opponent's play is kind of an unusual density there.
Can we throw Dovin's Veto into that as well?
No, I think Dovin's Veto is more of like them going, what other things can we do with counter spells? Let's make an uncounterable counter spell. I don't think of that being I usually don't think of counter spells as being like Staxy. What I think of is static effects.
Okay.
Static orb effects. I think of Winter Orb. I think of, you know, like Stasis, of course. Things that have, you know, static effects on them that lock out other players, or
I guess I was looking at Dovin's. I guess I was looking at Dovin's Veto more based on the fact that you're introducing an uncounterable counterspell to the 60 card constructive format. It's too standard, too modern, where you didn't necessarily have you didn't necessarily have any sort of analog or comparison for that. Because again, a lot of the like free counterspells, you don't have access to those in modern in some cases. So
I mean, if you think about it also, it's a little bit self-regulating, because standard people generally aren't slinging around super high power like Force of Will. They're not dazing people. They're not utilizing some of the other kind of broken counterspell kind of cards over the past, you know, 20, 25 years of Magic. They're not doing that as much, obviously, in a standard environment. So Dovin's Veto, I think, is less powerful in that kind of setting than it actually is, I think, in some of the other formats, like in, you know, like Legacy or in this case also in EDH. I think when it comes to rotating formats, I think cards that are just really good in terms of counterspell, I mean, there's not that many really good other counterspells that you'd want to, say, try to protect against. I mean, the most you're going to do with a Dovin's Veto is like Dovin's Veto something so that it itself can't be Dovin's Vetoed. So, like, there wasn't a whole lot of other high-powered stuff running around at the time. Or really ever in Standard. But in terms of the Eternal formats, Dovin's Veto, I think, really is kind of a superstar, which I think is why it's, like, a staple at this point.
I really don't know if it's much of a staple. Again, I haven't really dove in... for lack of a better term. That's oh bad. Man. So it took me that long to get a really bad pun in.
Hey, you haven't dove into this particular controversy yet.
Yeah. But yeah, I can definitely see how this would be a more useful card in the big mana formats of the Eternal
format. I think it's not even a particularly frustrating counterspell. But what it does do really well is it does help deal with things and deal with them effectively. It's kind of like that card in goodness, Azorius Supreme. Is it Supreme Verdict that's uncounterable?
Yeah.
And it's, for example, like Azorius is a tradition of making uncounterable things, like how just in the way that Supreme Verdict is an uncounterable board wipe, which some people might say, okay, what's the point of putting uncounterable on? I mean, it's not that many times people are going to try to counterspell something like that, but actually, like, in terms of things to counterspell, board wipes are probably like public enemy number one. Those are the big ticket items that people are going to want to try to counterspell, and so tacking that on makes it really good and also makes it special. I think it's the same thing with Dovin's Veto. Like, one of the most common things to counterspell is enemy counterspells on the stack, so when you play Dovin's Veto, you are preventing anyone from overstacking your counterspell effectively.
Mm-hmm. So really the way I look at War of the Spark is the fact that it was a very good set to really learn how to play the game in. Again, I talked about this at the beginning of the show. It has a lot of very simple strategies, a lot of +1/+1 counter synergies, a very good way for me to be able to learn as a new player. Just trying to understand how the game worked is if I can buff my creatures, I have a better chance to win. Well, you know, yeah. that's a good way to get new players into the game. You don't have a lot of complicated cards yet. Yes. Okay. I should say that there are a lot of complicated cards in this, but there are also a lot of really simple cards to understand, especially at the common and uncommon levels for someone who's new. As time goes on, you start learning really what these different cards do. But, you know, something like Storev, you can play that in the kitchen table deck and it's just fine. May not be the most powerful commander, but I mean, the fact is it's a very simple card. Deal combat damage, get a creature back from the graveyard. Very simple.
Yeah, I think it would be a really good set to introduce someone to play the game. I think that there were a lot of cards that were well designed. I think that there's a lot of balance between the different colors here. I mean, obviously, you know, some of the green cards are a little powerful.
The white cards are a little lacking if we want to look at it that way.
Yeah,
but they're easy to use, and that's
the thing. They are easy to use, and I think that the set is pretty well, otherwise, I think it's pretty well balanced.
If you take out, this set is extremely imbalanced in a lot of ways. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. Maybe that's the reason why a lot of people don't like it, is the fact it is extremely imbalanced.
It is imbalanced?
You have a ton of extremely powerful cards, the finales. You have Liliana in here.
At the rarity level.
Dragon God.
Talking more about like a person who's just starting out the common and uncommon level, kind of.
Yes. So what I'm trying to say here is that the mythics especially are just busted beyond belief. So if you take those out, and you just give people commons, uncommons, and rares, I do agree with you. This was a very good set for me to learn, to understand, because, again, if I had started even one set earlier with Ravnica Allegiance, there's a lot of stuff in there that's not necessarily easy for a new player to understand. There's a lot of different... Each guild has a mechanic, effectively. And you gotta figure it out. And also, you only really have support for five guilds. Well, War of the Spark allows you to have support for all 10 guilds. That's a big difference. And just the fact that no matter what two-color pairing or three-color pairing you want to go into, there's plenty to go around no matter what colors you choose.
Yeah.
And, you know, frankly, even mono green, mono black, mono red, mono blue, some cases mono white here, all have their own little archetypes if you're just playing kitchen table and you just want to throw a 60-card deck together and just play around them. I mean, honestly, again, I had a 60-card kitchen table mono green deck just filled with cards from this set for that reason.
Yeah, I think there was something for everyone in this set, definitely. At least I found a lot of stuff to my liking from it.
And you also have the extremely confusing card Niv-Mizzet Reborn, which is also a complete deck archetype in its own, in multiple formats.
Yeah, it's a pretty weird one.
6/6 Dragon Avatar cost Wooburg. Should have mentioned this earlier. I didn't, so I'm going to do it now.
Probably the weirdest Niv-Mizzet incarnation there has yet been.
Has flying.
He's basically Magic's unofficial mascot at this point. Yep. Well, one of them.
Yep, and when Niv-Mizzet Reborn enters the battlefield, reveal the top 10 cards of your library. For each color pair, again, if you're new to the game, you have no idea what they're talking about here. Choose a card that's exactly those colors from among them. Well, that's not confusing at all. Put the chosen cards into your hand and the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. So you're effectively tutoring up multicolored guild cards here. It's very powerful, but if you're new, good luck figuring it out. Especially if you... And then even just as an EDH player, it's five colors. Playing five color is not necessarily easy, especially not this.
Oh, yeah. And no, it's not. Five color is not a beginner strategy.
I mean, even now, I would consider this to be kind of a challenge as an EDH player. It's a very powerful card. It's just kind of... It's weirdly worded, excuse me, and, you know, it requires a lot of understanding about the game and deck building and whatnot, and that would definitely be an impediment to new players.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan, any more thoughts on this set? So basically, to wrap everything up, you and I would recommend this very good set for people to get into the game in if you take out all the busted mythics, effectively.
I'd say, like, this set or any of the core sets. Core sets also do a pretty good job. Actually, there's been a lot of sets that have been printed, I think, that would be good for people starting out. I think War of the Spark is a good one, though, because of how it balances its themes pretty well, aside from some of the mythics and stuff that were kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. And you do still have a lot of very good introductions to strategies. So you have things like Eternal Taskmaster. You have a card like Command the Dreadhorde. These are reanimation cards in black. But you also have Bolas' Citadel, which is extremely powerful for obvious reasons. Yeah. You have something like Aid the Fallen, which allows you to get a target creature card from your graveyard, put it back to your hand. But you also have other just basic cards like No Escape. Yeah. It's a counterspell. Kazmina's Transmutation. You can turn something into a 1/1 frog with no abilities.
Yeah.
You have all sorts of white weenie cards. You have a lot of flying, some life synergies here, ways to untap creatures, ways to destroy attacking creatures. Red just has a lot of very simple burn spells, demolish, destroy target, artifact, or land. I mean, it can't get any simpler than that.
Yeah.
Again, Honor the God Pharaoh gives you another mono-red draw engine. Even something like Samoth's Sprint, which is instant cost red, and target creature gets +2/+1 and gains haste until end of turn and scry 1. Well, that's not bad value at all.
Yeah.
Green just gives you a lot of the +1/+1 counter synergies. Arboreal Grazer, which allows you to put a free land card from your hand on the battlefield tapped. Free land card. Not a basic land. That's good. Evolution Sage is busted if you get a +1/+1 counter synergy going in a landfall deck. Mowu's just good in general. Return to Nature got reprinted, which destroys target artifact. Enchantment or exile target card from a graveyard. You have a whole bunch of planeswalkers that give your creatures abilities to do things. I like Neoform. Neoform is basically a one-time birthing pod.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you just have so many cards that, again, they're not busted in this set. And I think they're a really good way for new people to be able to learn how to be able to play the game while also being able to push the boundaries of their understanding as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of vanilla creatures in this set. There's a lot of things where you're not going to be playing them outside limited, but that's the point. These sets are built for limited. But I think as far as my opinion coming into the set, if this had been really complicated, I probably wouldn't have continued playing. But yeah. I was able to find the value, sift through what was good and what was not necessarily so good, and I just figured it out just by playing and by doing. All right, so that wraps up our talk about War of the Spark. Again, you can find the back catalog of all the Control Room episodes, as well as all of the episodes in the MTG and Quarantine podcast on Spotify, Google, Apple, Player, FM, MTGcast, and many, many other podcast outlets. Well,
hopefully this has been illuminating for people, and hopefully they've learned something about a not-so-old, but still a little older set that served as jumping-off point for the hobby.
Yeah. All right, so I want to thank you, Ryan, for taking the time to be on the show. It's been great having you.
Yeah, it's been great being on the podcast again.
All right, so again, for Ryan and myself, you've been listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. My name's MJ. Have a great rest of your day, everybody.